Knock, knock. Who's there? Inflation. Inflation who? Aren't you glad I didn't start with interest rates again? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the studios of Michigan Radio in Ann Arbor, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you with us, everybody. It is the 16th of September today, Wednesday, or as we like to call it, day one of the most important monetary policy meeting of the modern era. All right, I exaggerate, but not by too terribly much. By this time tomorrow, we are going to know whether Janet Yellen and the gang at the Federal Open Market Committee think the economy is strong enough to raise interest rates, or whether they think it's not. Dr. Yellen has said at pretty much every turn that the decision is going to depend on what the data says. And they got the last sliver of data they might be able to use this morning, courtesy of the Labor Department, which told us that consumer prices unexpectedly fell in August. Not much, but they fell. And that falling thing matters because consumer prices have a whole lot to do with inflation, which the Fed would really, really like to see steady out at about 2%. That's a tall order, one that the Fed, quite frankly, hasn't been able to meet, in part because of things well outside of its control, like global commodities prices, food and oil, just for instance, but also in part because of things inside this economy, wages and also jobs. On that topic, Marketplace's Kimberly Adams gets us going today.
Economists are scratching their heads as to why inflation just refuses to budge. I mean, the economy is getting stronger, unemployment is falling, GDP is growing.
But the real thing to be looking at is incomes and wages.
David Madland is with the Center for American Progress and says those two things aren't really moving, especially at the lower end of the economic scale. The gig economy and the masses of underemployed are making it harder for workers to get better pay.
And that's a real problem for the future of our economy, because if the middle class and most workers don't have money in their pockets, there's not going to be enough demand to drive the economy forward.
And demand is changing. Diane Lim of the Committee for Economic Development says millennials and baby boomers don't work or spend in the same way people used to.
You know, the economy is moving from a really goods-oriented economy to one of consuming experiences.
And those things are hard to quantify. So it's difficult to tell if the way we calculate inflation is really capturing consumer demand. Plus, keep in mind, that goal the Fed has for inflation, it's kind of arbitrary. Josh Bivens of the Economic Policy Institute.
It's just sort of a fudge. It's basically, we want a measure of quite low inflation. We'll just say 2%.
Because get too low and you're flirting with deflation, which nobody wants. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
All right, let's play out that wages thread that Kimberly was talking about for a minute here and its role in another government figure out today. The Census Bureau released its yearly poverty report. More than 46.5 million Americans live below the poverty line. That is a whole lot, but the poverty rate, that is the percentage of the population below the line, didn't change. Neither did median income. And that might go some way toward explaining why, even though the economy is technically in recovery, a lot of people just aren't feeling that. And one big reason is, here it is again, wages. Marketplace's Noel King has that.
I met Ryan Navalis about a year and a half ago. He works at a social services organization in Los Angeles called the Midnight Mission. Ryan loved his job, but he was struggling financially. Earlier this year, he was promoted.
I've, you know, gained a title and more responsibilities, and so that comes with more money, frankly.
He got a 10% pay bump, and now he has a car to get to work.
You know, that's a whole nother set of, you know, responsibilities and costs that you have to factor into all that.
All that includes rising rent and supporting his 9-year-old daughter. So he still has things squeezing him financially. That wage trend is something that Jane Waldfogel has seen. She's a professor at Columbia University who researches poverty and inequality. She noticed something in today's census release. By one measure, the level of child poverty went down, but that measure takes into account tax credits for low-income working people. Her conclusion is that government tax policy helped those kids, not, she says, that their parents made more money.
It's a pretty discouraging picture in terms of what people are making, and I think it's not coincidental that there's a lot of talk now about raising the minimum wage in a lot of localities and states.
Another discouraging sign in today's report, median income remained flat. Timothy Smeeting is a professor of economics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
No change in median income still means we're creating more jobs, but a lot of those jobs are part-time and pay low wages.
He says it's simple. The most successful poverty fighter for families is better earnings. In New York, I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
Fed meeting? What Fed meeting? Traders don't need no stinking Fed meeting. They were buying into that interest rate decision. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It's easy to get all highfalutin and macroeconomic when you're talking about the Fed and interest rates. But here's the thing. What the Fed decides tomorrow, and whenever it does decide to raise interest rates, because eventually, believe you me, it will, that's going to reach out and grab every single one of us right in the wallet. So as we consider what might happen tomorrow, let's think for a second about who has benefited from interest rates being so low for so long. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports that it's been the borrowers among us.
So we're talking about people like 36-year-old Drew Wood of Minneapolis and his wife, Vanessa. They have two kids, a Boston Terrier, and a very low interest rate on their mortgage.
Who's got the best dad ever?
Me. And I got to turn the lantern on.
On this busy weekday morning, Drew Wood is flying around, getting his 1- and 4-year-old girls ready for the day, dealing with whatever pressing matters come up.
I gotta go potty.
Somehow, amidst the chaos, Wood finds the time to tell me their interest rate story.
It was like basically December 2012 that we bought this house. That was when we closed at 3.125%.
That's right. He said 3.125%, about half the interest rate on the mortgage for their first house, which they bought just 3 years earlier and would soon outgrow. Wood says the low interest rates were like a springboard, giving them an incentive to move to a bigger house a bit sooner than they'd planned. Oh, and along the way, their bank sold their student loan and they got a nice surprise.
Actually, the payments have gone down a little bit, and it has to be because of interest rates. I don't know what else I could attribute that to. It's not like when it got sold, those guys are like, yeah, you know what? We'll take a little bit off the top. You owe us less.
Wood and his family aren't the only ones paying less on loans. Let's escape the chaos and zip over to Silicon Valley, where it's easier than ever for tech startups to borrow or raise money. Low interest rates have driven investors to make riskier deals, hoping for better payoffs than they get from anemic savings accounts. Scott Rainey is a venture capitalist in San Francisco, a partner at Redpoint Ventures. He says investors are almost throwing money at entrepreneurs.
That fear of missing out is driving a lot of very aggressive competitive behavior where people are competing tooth and nail to get in these projects.
But even if people aren't throwing money at you, you are benefiting indirectly. Low interest rates have saved the government and taxpayers a lot of money. Lower borrowing costs have brought down the federal budget deficit. Ernie Cecilia is chief investment officer at Bryn Mawr Trust Company. He says even a school district that borrowed, say, $5 million on the bond market could save big.
Let's say they were able to save 1% per year on the borrowing. That would be a savings of $50,000.
Basically, if you borrow big when interest rates are low, you save big. But not everybody can do that. Jeffrey Dorfman is an economist at the University of Georgia. He says low-income Americans don't usually own a home. They tend to borrow money through payday loans or credit cards.
The interest rates on both of those have not particularly been affected by the Fed's interest rate policy.
Dorfman says rates on credit cards are down 15%, but mortgage rates have fallen 40%.
So poor people are still paying a lot of interest in order to get access to some money.
Dorfman says by keeping interest rates so low for so long, the Fed has widened the wealth gap in the U.S. He's been calling on the Fed to raise interest rates to level the playing field. We'll find out tomorrow if the Fed was listening. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
That sound you hear coming from the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library today is the sound of CNN counting its money. I mean, yes, there is going to be a debate, and in theory, one of the people on that stage could be the next president of the United States. But television being a business and all, CNN is reaping a windfall in advertising dollars and viewers because political debates are great news for television news, at least for now. Marketplace's Sabree Benishore has that story.
The Fox News debate last month was the ninth most viewed cable program ever. The other eight were college football games. Now it is CNN's turn.
This is going to be huge for CNN.
That's Billy Gold. She does programming research with Dentsu Aegis. And actually, it's not going to be huge for CNN. It's going to be huge.
What a great honor it must be for you to honor me tonight.
CNN is charging, by some reports, 40 times its normal advertising price, $150 or even $200,000 for 30 seconds. Now, for networks, debates are a big deal money-wise, but they are not the biggest deal.
Because a debate program is a couple of hours long, it has very limited amount of commercial time.
John Swallen is chief research officer at Kantar Media.
The bigger story here, I think, is just the impact on audience ratings to news programming in general.
Campaign cycles always bump up viewership for news networks. This year, the numbers of viewers and revenue are up early, says Swallen. But if you look at the big picture for TV and cable networks, the campaign season looks like a sunny day in hurricane season. Why? Cord cutting.
People are transitioning away from pay TV video in favor of online products.
Eric Brannon is principal analyst for TV at IHS.
And this is the first time we actually noticed honest-to-God cord cutting that looked scary.
So yes, this campaign season could be the biggest in history in terms of TV ad revenue. But it may be the last biggest one. Because 5 years from now, we may not even be talking about TV ads much at all. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Coming up, y'all can stop guessing now.
If hail falls in St. Petersburg on the same day an albino heifer is birthed on the plains, the Fed will lower interest rates.
You heard it here first, folks. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 140 points, about 0.8% today, closed at 16,739. The NASDAQ up 28 points, 0.6%, 4889. The S&P 500 gained 17 points, 0.8%, ended things at 1,009.95. Molson Coors fizzed up 14.25% today. That after Anheuser-Busch InBev said it will make a bid for Molson's joint venture partner SAB Miller. Anheuser-Busch bounced up 6.4%, although I must, and yes, this is editorializing, say that I don't think there's a lot of actual beer involved in this one. Falling oil inventories gave a boost to oil and energy stocks for a second day. Chevron arched up 2.4%. Hewlett-Packard up almost 5% today after announcing another 30,000 layoffs. Yesterday, you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's all about connectivity now, right? Not only us with our phones in our pockets all the time, but also cars and thermostats and refrigerators. It's called the Internet of Things. And that connectivity is spreading to medical devices, too. But as more pacemakers and IV pumps come online, so too does risk. From KERA in Dallas, Lauren Silverman reports.
Administering drugs to a hospital patient used to be so analog. Brandy Crow says up until 20 or so years ago, she and other nurses counted drops or made calculations by hand to determine the correct rate and amount of IV fluid and medications. These days, so-called smart pumps determine the dosages of everything from antibiotics and pain meds to chemotherapy drugs.
You know, they're wireless. They're on the hospital wireless network. You don't think about anybody really breaching that. Why would they want to get into a medical device?
Crow, who's an analyst with healthcare research company MD Byline, says hospitals are starting to respond to the potential danger of smart infusion pumps.
You're worried about, you know, someone going in and getting out a patient's medical history or personal health information. You can get financial information. You can get all kinds of things through that. And so whether it's malicious or not malicious, I mean, you open yourself up for considerable risk.
Jay Radcliffe, a hacker and type 1 diabetic, knows the benefits and dangers of medical devices firsthand. 4 years ago, he hacked his own insulin pump and was able to write a program to turn it on and off, even to change the therapy settings.
The battle is that the technology moves a lot faster than the regulatory agencies do. So they're a little bit behind on making sure that these internet-enabled computers that are hooked up to people, delivering them medicine, are safe to be on the internet.
The risk of a hack has caught the attention of the Food and Drug Administration. Earlier this summer, for the first time, the FDA warned caregivers to stop using a specific infusion pump because of its vulnerability to hacking. At the same time, wirelessly connected pumps can save lives. Dan Pettis with device company CareFusion says smart pumps makes treating patients safer and more efficient.
A connected system gives somebody remotely the ability to view what's happening at the patient's bedside. Could be very valuable for a pharmacist to check the order or a nurse.
The challenge is keeping up with the technological changes. Radcliffe, who now works for cybersecurity company Rapid7, says many hospitals still use pumps that are 10 years old, which he compares to using a Windows 95 computer for financial transactions. That's where Marty Edwards comes in. He's the director of, get ready for it,
the Industrial Control Systems Cyber Emergency Response Team.
Yes, it's a governmental organization. Basically, he works for the Department of Homeland Security, helping device makers plug holes in their security systems.
This embedded area, these smaller Internet of Things types of devices, they seem to be lagging behind, and they need to work towards fixing that.
He says there has been progress. Device makers are increasingly collaborating with hackers to identify and fix flaws. Those flaws include weak passwords. Hacker Jay Radcliffe says hospitals sometimes buy infusion pumps off the shelf and stick with the default password. Still, he's not overly concerned.
If I'm in a hospital and I'm in a life-threatening situation and I need to be hooked up to a medical device, the risks of me dying far outweigh any minor risk of an attack that could occur from a cybersecurity issue.
As medical devices learn to talk to each other, Radcliffe says it's also important patients, hackers, and hospitals stay connected to keep ahead of new threats. In Dallas, I'm Lauren Silverman for Marketplace.
There was a thing that happened last week called Grindfest, a gathering of people who enjoy experimenting with electronic modifications to the human body, a convention of sorts where they can test new equipment and share ideas. It's a technology story with an acutely human twist. Dylan Matthews from Vox.com was there and participated to a degree when he got a microchip implanted in his left hand. Dylan, thanks for coming on.
Pleasure to be here.
First question has to be, why did you get a computer chip implanted into your hand?
Well, there are a number of reasons. One is the sheer novelty of it.
Yes.
I had an opportunity. I figured I was not going to have many more opportunities to casually get a chip implanted into my hand. But more seriously, there were some practical applications that I thought I could use it for. I'm currently talking with the building manager for a company in D.C. about using my hand as a key fob. I'm always fumbling for my keys, but, you know, my hand's right there.
All right, so let me back you up for a minute then. I mean, because sure, that all sounds cool and whiz-bang and, oh, my gosh, the future is here. Let me back you up. You went to this thing called a grind fest, right? Biohacking, basically.
Right.
Give me a list of some of the, you know, like the top three things people are doing, people in this community are doing.
Sure. So the most universal one was putting chips inside.
Right.
The second most common was probably magnetic implants in fingertips, which turns you into a very sort of low-rent version of Magneto from the X-Men. You can lift paper clips and various other very light metallic objects. So it's a fun party trick.
Okay.
And the third one I was going to mention is Rich Lee, who's a prominent biohacker who was at the event, blazed the trail for a kind of implant known as tragus implants, where...
What?
So the tragus is this bunch of cartilage sort of on your outer ear, the sort of hard part right in the middle of your ear. And so he basically has earbuds implanted into his ears permanently.
Which is really cool, I guess, and could eventually put, I don't know, earbud manufacturers out of business if this gets adopted at scale. But and this is a point you make in your piece, the technology we really want, right? The biohacking stuff we really want, like robotic hearts and stuff like that, we're not even there yet.
We're not there yet, but we're getting there. So one example of a midterm thing that's probably a few years off, but is not sort of super speculative, would be an implant that could detect the enzymes that are released from your heart when you go into cardiac arrest. That's something you can pick up in your blood, and people already have implants that can run sort of very basic blood tests. If you expanded that capacity, if you were able to do more sophisticated blood tests, you could imagine an implant that can tell within seconds or even a fraction of a second whether you're having a heart attack that is connected to a cellular network and can call 911 and can dramatically improve response time for emergencies like that.
Okay, so let's get back to you for a second and the chip in your hand. I have, as you might imagine, some questions. You ready?
Sure. You and my mother.
Yeah, I bet. It's tiny, so I'm guessing it doesn't set off like metal detectors at the airport. That's all cool?
It doesn't. I went through TSA yesterday, not a peep.
Okay. Do you worry about being hacked? What kind of information is on this thing?
So the thing about it is it's near-field communication and RFID. These are very short-distance technologies. It's not like some hacker in China can go and make their way into it.
Not yet, man.
Not yet.
Right.
It is something I worry about, and I think it's something that people will have to worry about as more and more personal information gets on this stuff.
But play this out for a minute. There is a not-too-distant future where I can wave my RFID chip that I have in my hand at a payment thing, and it will deduct it from my checking account, right? Or whatever.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And I think that's one of the things that's going to drive development of this, that if you can imagine the increase in consumption, if purchasing things becomes that easy, it's very, very attractive to retailers.
Dylan Matthews, he's a senior correspondent at Vox.com, and he has a little chip in his hand. Dylan, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
There's been no small amount of Kremlinology going on as we've all tried to figure out what's going to happen tomorrow interest rate-wise. There's been parsing of speeches, dissection of meeting minutes, all in search of the answer to this question. What is the Fed going to do? Sam Weiner has some thoughts.
For the answer, we can turn to our old friend, the Banker's Almanac. Like the Farmer's Almanac, the Banker's version provides valuable predictions based on top-secret meteorological data and homespun claptrap. Here's what the Banker's Almanac advises. If cumulus clouds are spotted moving southeast above Washington, D.C.'s Capitol Dome, look for interest rates to rise. If those same clouds are spotted, but they appear to be in the shape of a giant dollar sign, expect the Fed to send a check for $10 to every American. If hail falls in St. Petersburg on the same day an albino heifer is birthed on the plains, the Fed will lower interest rates, but may require the heads of the nation's six largest banks to slaughter the unholy cow themselves. If the entire sky turns black, all crops nationwide wither, and our rivers turn to blood, that means war with the hated Babylonian Empire and lower borrowing rates. Finally, if economic fundamentals continue to improve, there is a chance the Fed will raise those rates. But there's an equally strong chance that the Fed will dissolve itself in recognition that an economy created by men is nothing but a shared delusion. And while the Banker's Almanac may not be reliable in any way, remember that it's just as accurate as every economist ever.
Sam Weiner writes for BuzzFeed. You can find more of his stuff at our website, marketplace.org. Today, by the way, is your very last chance to play along in our fun new parlor game, What is Janet Yellen Thinking? In five words or less, you can hit us up on Twitter. We are at Marketplace. Also, while I'm at it, and at the risk of commingling big news events, I'm going to be live tweeting the GOP debate tonight, all 2 hours and 45 minutes of it, if you can believe it's going to last that long. I am at Kai Rizdahl. This final note on the way out today, in which I am very sad to have to tell you, we may be witnessing the last gasp of online dating. There's a new app out there designed to help you find love. It's called Sizzle, S-I-Z-Z-L, in that way that apps have of dropping unnecessary vowels. But oh no, it is not your love life that is meant to sizzle, although that would be a nice fringe benefit, I suppose. No, this app lets you look for a life partner based on your mutual bacon preferences. Yes, it's advertising. It's from Oscar Mayer, and it is in the App Store. It's real. Also, I am not making this up. Just occurred to me that depending on what they do tomorrow, the Fed might be able to extend our little What Would Janet Yellen Do game. We'll let you know tomorrow on the program. Today, though, the Dow climbed 140 points, 8 tenths of 1%. The NASDAQ up 28 points, 6 tenths percent. The S&P 500 gained 17 points, 8 tenths of 1%. Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Garrett Lang, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. Thanks today to the staff at Michigan Radio. We're here again tomorrow. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you then. And this is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.